Hello, and welcome to Discussions with DPIC. I'm Anne Holsinger, the Information and Resource Specialist at the Death Penalty Information Center. Today we will be speaking with Professor John Bloom about intellectual disability and the Supreme Court case Moore v. Texas. John Bloom is a professor at Cornell Law School and the director of the Cornell Death Penalty Project. He has argued 8 cases before the Supreme Court and has written extensively on many death penalty issues, particularly intellectual disability. Thank you for joining us, Professor Bloom.
Sure, I'm very happy to be here.
So we're here today to talk about Moore v. Texas, which the Supreme Court will hear oral argument in tomorrow on November 29th. And that case addresses the unusual criteria used by the state of Texas to determine if a prisoner has intellectual disability and is therefore exempt from execution. Before we get into the details of Moore, could you give our listeners a quick summary of Atkins versus Virginia, the 2002 case that banned the execution of people with intellectual disabilities?
Yes. In Atkins versus Virginia, the Supreme Court held that the Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution creates a categorical bar preventing the execution of people with intellectual disability. And the court reached this conclusion and created this bar for 2 reasons. First, it found that there was a national and international consensus against executing persons with intellectual disability. And they found this consensus in the fact that a growing number of states legislatively precluded the practice. They found that even in the states that did allow it as a matter of law, that they very rarely sought or obtained the death penalty against persons with intellectual disability, and that persons with intellectual disability were decreasingly being actually executed even if they were sentenced to death. And so taking that into account, as well as various public opinion polls, the views of interested organizations, the court found that there was a consensus against executing persons with intellectual disability. And then the court exercised what we refer to as its own constitutional judgment and concluded that executing people with intellectual disability did not further either the deterrence or the retributive purposes of capital punishment. And it also noted that persons with intellectual disability were at a heightened risk of wrongful execution due to factors like the greater possibility of confessing falsely, the inability to adequately testify on their own behalf, and the fact that their demeanor may give an inaccurate impression of lack of remorse. So looking at all those considerations, the court concluded that the Eighth Amendment's cruel and unusual punishment clause prevented the executions of persons with intellectual disability.
And in that ruling, the court relied on clinical definitions of intellectual disability. But despite that, many states have adopted what you have described as non-clinical and unscientific practices for determining whether a defendant is intellectually disabled. What criteria are used to determine intellectual disability in a clinical setting, and how do courts typically determine intellectual disability in a death penalty case?
Well, intellectual disability has several objective clinical components which are consistent in the main definitions of intellectual disability. And it's essentially a 3-prong test. So the first prong is what's referred to as significantly subaverage intellectual functioning, which means that the person has to have an IQ on an individualized, gold standard IQ test of 70 plus or minus 5 points for what is known as the standard error of measurement. This captures approximately the bottom 2% of the population in terms of intellectual functioning. The second prong has to do with deficits in adaptive functioning. And this criteria looks at really how the significantly subaverage intellectual functioning affects the person's ability to really live in the world. And it looks at things like their practical academic skills, their communication skills, the social skills, and conceptual skills, and what deficits the individual has in those areas. And then the third prong is what is referred to as onset in the developmental period. Intellectual disability is a developmental disorder. In other words, it's a disorder of childhood, as distinguished from other conditions like traumatic brain injury. For example, if I were to leave here today and walking back to my office, I were to fall and have a major head injury and my IQ were to go to 65 because of that, and I were to have deficits in adaptive functioning, I wouldn't be a person with intellectual disability because it happened to me later in life. I would be a person with traumatic brain injury as opposed to a person with intellectual disability. And so those are the criteria which clinicians use in determining whether someone has intellectual disability. And those are really the criteria that I would say a majority of the states use in assessing what we refer to as Atkins claims.
So most courts rely on a pretty clear clinical definition like the one you described.
Yes, I think most courts faithfully apply the clinical definitions that have, you know, were set out, which the Supreme Court used in the Atkins decision itself, and which are found generally in their own laws for determining things like benefits or eligibility for special education classes. I think most states are doing it really according to those three criteria.
You mentioned earlier that when the court ruled in Atkins that the death penalty could not be imposed on people with intellectual disability, it said that there was a national consensus against the practice, which suggests that the states that permitted it were out of step with that national consensus. Why then were those states allowed to set their own rules about who is or is not intellectually disabled?
Well, I don't think really that they were. I think a lot of this, what we see in Moore and what we saw in Hall, which I know we'll be talking about at some point, has resulted from states either miss or at a minimum overinterpreting what I have described in a number of articles and discussions as unfortunate language in the Atkins opinion. Near the end of Atkins, the court said, "We leave it to the states to develop ways to enforce the constitutional mandate." And some states have said that gives them the authority to modify the generally recognized clinical definition of intellectual disability that we've been talking about. But I don't really think that's what the court meant. I think the court was referring to matters of timing and procedure, like will you make the intellectual disability decision pre-trial or during the penalty phase of a capital trial? Things like who will make the decision, a judge or jury? And things like that, matters of really procedure. I don't think they had in mind that states could alter the generally recognized clinically understood definition of intellectual disability, because that could create a situation, has created a situation, where the Eighth Amendment means one thing in Texas and another in, for example, South Carolina or Ohio.
So in 2014, the court addressed Florida's unusual intellectual disability criteria in a case called Hall versus Florida. And in that case, they rejected Florida's use of a strict IQ cutoff of 70, which addressed the first of the three prongs used in determining intellectual disability, that prong being significantly subaverage intellectual functioning. How has that decision affected Florida and other states?
Well, as your question suggests, Hall dealt with state deviation from clinical consensus on prong one of the definition, significantly subaverage intellectual functioning. And the court held that states couldn't deviate from clinical consensus by creating a hard, bright line IQ score cutoff. Now, in its narrowest perspective, that saved Freddie Lee Hall's life, and he was found to be a person with intellectual disability. But there have also been a number of other cases where persons have been found to have intellectual disability and thus to fall within Atkins' categorical bar protection, as they should have been for people who had IQs in the low 70s and thus were within the standard error of measurement. So Hall has had an impact not only on Hall, but on other individual cases. But I think Hall also sent a message, which was received by many states, that they are required by the Eighth Amendment to adhere to clinical consensus. Now, not all states have gotten the message, and I think in Moore versus Texas, the question will be whether the court's going to enforce that same rule in looking at Texas, particularly idiosyncratic ways of defining intellectual disability.
Right. So you just began to address the fact that Texas uses a particularly idiosyncratic set of criteria known as the Briseño factors, which are based partially on a judge's impression of the character Lenny Smalls from the novel Of Mice and Men. Could you describe the Briseño factors and how they differ from other state systems?
The Briseño factors come from a Texas Court of Criminal Appeals decision, Ex parte Briseño, which the state court issued pretty soon after the Supreme Court's decision in Atkins itself. And in Briseño, the Court of Criminal Appeals was actually, in my view, quite clear that its mission was to try and limit the impact of the Supreme Court's Atkins decision in Texas. And it said that while, look, most Texans would agree that John Steinbeck's fictional character Lenny from Of mice in men should not be executed. There would be other people who might meet the clinical definition of intellectual disability who Texans would not agree should be exempt from execution. And so they established the Briseño evidentiary factors for courts to consider. And these factors are really steeped in stereotype of what people with intellectual disability can do and can't do. And many also not only stereotypical but non-clinical considerations, such as did people who knew the person in their younger years think they were intellectually disabled? Can the person lie effectively? Does the person show leadership or are they led? Can the person hide facts? Does the person respond rationally? Can the person formulate plans? Is their conduct rational in response to external stimuli? These are a number of factors which are really subject to misuse, misinterpretation, and are inconsistent with clinical consensus. And really, Texas is an outlier in using these factors in the Atkins intellectual disability context. And it's also, I think, important to note that Texas doesn't use these Briseño factors in any other intellectual disability context. For example, if a person with intellectual disability were trying to get benefits, for Social Security benefits, if a person with intellectual disability were trying to determine whether they qualified for special education, in no other context except in the death penalty context does Texas use these non-clinical Briseño factors.
How do those factors differ from what a mental health professional would evaluate to determine whether a person has adaptive deficits?
Well, I think a clinician who is doing an intellectual disability evaluation in good faith would look at the clinical definition of deficits in adaptive functioning, because the Briseño factors are really meant to go to prong two. Does the person have deficits in adaptive functioning? And a clinician would really look at the individual's weaknesses as opposed to their strengths. And what Texas courts have done is take these factors and use them to reject very strong claims of intellectual disability, such as that in Mr. Moore's case, because of things like, well, the person's able to adjust to life in a maximum security prison. Or the person lied to the police when they were arrested, or the person fled after the crime, or all kinds of things which are completely consistent with a person having intellectual disability. And due to the Briseño factors, claims of intellectual disability, which would be successful in most other death penalty jurisdictions, lose. Texas has one of the lowest success rates in the Atkins context of states that retain the death penalty, and that low success rate is primarily driven by the use of the Briseño factors.
So on November 29th, the day after we're recording this podcast, the Supreme Court will be considering the constitutionality of the Briseño factors when it hears the case of Bobby James Moore. Could you describe what happened in Mr. Moore's case that led to this appeal?
Mr. Moore was convicted of a capital murder in Texas and sentenced to death. And subsequently, a challenge was filed in his case alleging that he was a person with intellectual disability and thus fell within the Atkins Eighth Amendment categorical exemption from capital punishment. And so when his claim was reviewed by the Texas courts, the Texas trial court level judge found that he was a person with intellectual disability. And that judge used the definition of intellectual disability, the clinical consensus definition we've been talking about. The state wasn't happy with that decision, and they appealed it to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. And the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals rejected Mr. Moore's claim in three separate ways, all of which are inconsistent with really the clinical consensus and the generally understood definitions of intellectual disability. The first thing they did was they rejected current clinical definitions, and they focused on really Mr. Moore's strengths as opposed to his weakness. The court looked at things like, well, he was able to make some money mowing grass, and he was able to survive on the streets as a homeless person, and he was able to work as a barber in prison. And they ignored not only the fact that a person with intellectual disability can easily do all of those things, but they also ignored the deficits that Mr. Moore has in his adaptive functioning, that he was never able to live independently, that he couldn't manage his financial affairs, that he had a history of school and academic failure. And so they focused on the strengths and even did that stereotypically and ignored his deficits. The second thing they did was they embraced a strict but-for causation requirement for the adaptive functioning deficits. Mr. Moore, like many people who has intellectual disability, has some other problems. It's been recognized he has some severe emotional problems which were caused by parental abuse. And the state court said, well, yeah, he may have some of these deficits in adaptive functioning, but they really could be caused by his emotional problems as opposed to his low intellectual functioning. And this creates really an impossible evidentiary burden for people, for Atkins claimants to meet. And then third, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals used the Briseño factors in a similar manner that I've described above to reject the claim, looking at things like, well, Mr. Moore's prison conduct, the fact that he wore a wig at the time of the offense, and other factors mentioned in Briseño to reject his claim.
So if the court grants relief to Mr. Moore tomorrow, what would that mean for the Briseño factors, for Texas's system, and for determinations of intellectual disability in other states?
Well, we'll need to see exactly what the court does. But if, at a minimum, it says that the Briseño factors are inconsistent with clinical consensus, that would be a significant step forward. Now, at the moment, claims of intellectual disability are virtually impossible to win in Texas. But I think a ruling by the court saying that the Briseño factors are inconsistent with clinical consensus would be really a logical follow-up to Hall, which took care of state deviation on prong one, and this would be a significant step forward on prong two. If the court hopefully also rejects this very strict relatedness requirement, as they should, as being inconsistent with clinical definition, that would really go even further into bringing not only Texas, but a few other states in line with the generally recognized diagnostic criteria for intellectual disability.
What broader changes do you think would be necessary to bring state determinations of intellectual disability in criminal cases in line with scientific consensus?
Well, I think what we really need from the court here, they came close to saying this in Hall, but they didn't quite get there. I think, what we need from the court is a clear statement about what it meant and did not mean by the "we leave it to the states" language in Atkins. As I noted previously, the Eighth Amendment can't mean something different in every state. It's a federal constitutional barrier to execution, and as such, it must have the same substantive content in every state. It can't be that someone has intellectual disability and thus immune from execution in South Carolina, but not intellectually disabled and can be executed in Texas. That would be the height of arbitrariness. So if the court just says, look, that's not what we were talking about, states don't have license to deviate from the generally recognized clinical consensus understanding of intellectual disability, that would go a long way into hopefully preventing the court from having to continue to sort of micromanage these recalcitrant states. Because I think what you saw in Hall and what you see in Texas in the Briseño factors is these are states who really weren't happy with the Supreme Court's decision in Atkins itself and disagreed with the fact that the court created this bar to execution. And so these various deviations from clinical consensus are an attempt to limit its impact. And the court just needs to say, no, we meant what we said in Atkins. The Eighth Amendment means the same thing in any jurisdiction that retains the death penalty, and states have to adhere to clinical consensus.
Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your expertise with us today. We really appreciate it.
I'm happy to do so.
To learn more about the death penalty and intellectual disability, visit deathpenaltyinfo.org. And to make sure that you receive every episode of our podcast, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice.